Psalms 17. And we got down as far as verse 8 last time. David is in the midst of begging the Lord to intervene for him against his adversaries. And so he says in verse 8, among other things, keep me as the apple of the eye. And you learned in closing last time that Israel, Jerusalem, of course, besides David and some other persons, is the apple of God's eye, so you don't want to mess with that. He says in verse 8, hide me under the shadow of thy wings. I think we talked about that as well. And you go read Psalm 91 and you find that the shadow of the Lord's wings is where you'd want to be. I mean, he says, I would have gathered Jerusalem as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, and you would not. And so it's an issue of fellowship and shelter and refuge, and you want to take advantage of all that you can. Now, the counterpart of that in the Word of God is the shadow of death. It's interesting because the shadow of death in the book of Job, which is a book that typifies the Great Tribulation, Job was on the ground 7 days, all those sort of things. And it occurs 10 times in the book of Job, and there's indications that the shadow of death has a great deal to do with the Great Tribulation. Let me shake you to just a couple passages here. Look in Psalm 44, if you would, real quick. Shadow of death. Whether it's just generally the idea of death hanging around and being nearby, or whether there actually is some sort of... some have speculated there's a cloud of some sort in the Great Tribulation that overshadows folks and they die because of whatever. I'm not sure if it's nuclear or what, but I don't know that that's the case, and it's speculative. But look in Psalm chapter 44 and verse 19. Notice the context here, and it's a little bit shadowy, but though thou hast sore broken us in the place of dragons. Now that's him saying that that's broken us, Israel, in the place of dragons. Well, place of dragons, among other places you'd find in Isaiah 13 and Isaiah 34, might be the land of Edom, where, you know, eventually the lake of fire shows up during the millennium. So maybe it's that group of folks that are down there in Selah Petra. And it says, and covered us with the shadow of death. If we have forgotten the name of our God or stretched out our hands to a strange God, shall not God search this out? For he knoweth the secrets of the heart. Yea, for thy sake we are killed all the day long. We are counted as sheep for the slaughter. That's where the passage in Romans 8 drew from. And the draw there is the Jews being in great tribulation and being slaughtered right and left out in the wilderness. And when they are caught out, they're probably killed there. Verse 23, awake, why sleepest thou, O Lord? Arise, cast us not off forever. Wherefore hidest thou thy face and forgettest our affliction and our oppression? Now, eventually, the Lord shows up and pleads with Israel face to face out in the wilderness in the Great Tribulation. That's true. At this point, he apparently is not. And so they're pleading with him to show up and show his face because of the shadow of death. Just one more thing along that line. Look in Isaiah chapter 9. Isaiah 9. This is finishing what I didn't get a chance to finish in relation to the shadow of his wings. It sure is a blessing, as tough as it is sometimes, to maintain an intimate, close, active fellowship with God under the shadow of His wings. It sure is a blessing that you don't have to operate under the shadow of death prophetically. It sure is a blessing that whatever death holds for us, we go through that veil and it's all light on the other side. Look in Isaiah chapter 9, and let me go back into chapter 8 for a context, and notice verse 19, and when they shall say unto you, seek unto them that have familiar spirits, and unto wizards that peep and that mutter, should not a people seek unto their God for the living to the dead? And the answer, of course, is yes. To the law and to the testimony, if they speak not according to this word, it is because there is no light in them. A great verse. But then verse 21, and they shall pass through it is a question, hardly bestead and hungry, And it shall come to pass that when they shall be hungry, they shall fret themselves and curse their king and their God and look upward. You recall in the great tribulation in Revelation, folks still continue to blaspheme and curse God even in spite of all of the things that they're going through. And verse 22, and they shall look under the earth and behold trouble, darkness, dimness of anguish, and they shall be driven to darkness. And I think that's describing the tribulation. Notice what follows. Nevertheless, the dimness shall not be such as was in her vexation, when at the first he lightly afflicted the land of Zebulun, the land of Naphtali, and afterward did more grievously afflict her by the way of the sea beyond Jordan in Galilee of the nations. Talking about things were really bad, then things got really worse. Then verse 2, the people that walked in darkness have seen a great light. They that dwell in the land of the shadow of death, upon them hath the light shined. And again, if the context is tribulation, then there's something going on out there where people are dying right and left, and they're waiting for God to come back to shine upon them, His face to shine upon them. That passage is cited in Matthew chapter 4, verse 16, for the first time that Christ showed up. And He says that that light has shined where it was dim. But the context is back in Isaiah 8 and 9, and there's something to do with the great tribulation there. Anyway, verse 8 of Psalm 17. Keep me as the apple of the eye. Hide me under the shadow of thy wings from the wicked. There's another tribulation context. Look in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. And I believe there's only one place in the New Testament or in the Bible where wicked is, I may be wrong about that by the way, where wicked is capitalized. It's interesting that in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 and verse 8, wicked is capitalized, and then shall that wicked be revealed. That wicked is the Antichrist. That wicked is the devil incarnate. This is the middle of the tribulation there in 2 Thessalonians 2, 8. And so whenever I see wicked in a context that is related to a tribulation, I automatically see that as a dual thing. Sure, it's true of generally wicked people, but it's also prophetically true of the Antichrist. So here's David desiring relief and deliverance from his enemies. Verse 9, from the wicked that oppress me, and from my deadly enemies who compass me about. Israel in the great tribulation, well, they're compassed about now, I suppose you could say. In the great tribulation, it gets worse. They are surrounded round about in Jerusalem. They get warning. They see the abomination that maketh desolate sat in the holy place. They are commanded to flee to the wilderness, flee to the mountains, where they go out and they see God there face to face, as in days of old. They probably, as Micah 7 says, are fed once again out in that land for a brief period of time. Like those men, like the people of Israel were fed in the wilderness. They probably receive manna once again. They're supernaturally protected, although many of them die. Look in verse 9, from the wicked that oppress me, from my deadly enemies who compass me about. They are enclosed in their own fat. So they're pretty fat. They're enclosed in their own fat. With their mouth they speak proudly. They have now compassed us in our steps. Again, it's like a siege. They're completely surrounded. They're surrounded now, but again, you think about those folks fleeing down to Selah Petra, out to Carmel, down to Edom, where there's nothing but enemies round about, all pointing their weaponry at them. It says, they have now compassed us in our steps. They have set their eyes bowing down to the earth. I think the idea there is, verse 12, like as a lion. The idea, a lion, you see, going to a stalk. And he creeps down on his belly, and his eyes are glued down on the trail and where he's laying in wait for the prey to come along. He said that's what we are like. We're like being hunted and trailed down the way by a lion. Like as a lion that is greedy of his prey, and as it were a young lion lurking in secret places. So, in ambuscade. Verse 13, arise, O Lord, disappoint him, cast him down, deliver my soul from the wicked. There's that wicked again. So again, two wickeds and two lions. Verse 9, verse 12, verse 13, it looks pretty strong for a tribulation context. So that's why I say, you're reading through Psalms and the average devotional reader looks at it and gains strength from it, sees some things going on devotionally in life, and it applies that way. But there's also a very much deeper doctrinal prophetic context of most of Psalms. There's so much of Psalms that has to do with the tribulation and then the second coming of Christ, it's not even funny. And so again, you're pointed to a book here that's not one-dimensional at all. You know, you go read a novel, you know, Moby Dick or something else that's, you know, less well-known, less famous. And no matter what you say, I mean, I don't know how many times you have to read a complicated book through to get it, but it's not like it's multidimensional. When you read the Bible, it's multidimensional. There's more than one application. You have history, you have devotion, devotionally, spiritually, some things that happen, and there's even more than one way to apply it that way. And then you have prophetically and doctrinally, and sometimes there's even more than one way that way that it's true. So there are some things that happened the first time Christ came that were only partially fulfilled. They were fulfilled in part, but they will be fulfilled more in whole in yet the future. So you only not only have history, you have prophetic something going on in the same passage. And then you have personal lessons for you. And so the book is like, if you take devotional, historic, and just prophetic, just doctrinal, then you have a book that's three times as thick as this, if you divide it that way. And I'm not convinced at all that all passages just have three meanings, just three applications. I think that many times there are more multiple applications than that. So you have a book that's literally multidimensional. Look in Psalms in chapter 17 and verse 13. Arise, O Lord, disappoint him. Cast him down, deliver my soul from the wicked, which is thy sword. Now there's a troublesome statement. It says that the wicked is thy sword. Look in a few places. Isaiah 10. This should help you when you look and see who runs nations. In fact, at times, who has run this nation, maybe even who now runs this nation. Look in Isaiah chapter 10. What most folks don't understand is that they don't understand that God oftentimes dictates who runs things. Look at Isaiah 10 and notice that the wicked are the Lord's sword. Look in chapter 10 and go down to verse 5. Isaiah chapter 10, verse 5. Now he's talking to the Assyrian. O Assyrian, you know, recall the Assyrian came in and carried away the children of Israel, the 10 northern tribes of Israel, well before the two southern tribes were carried away by Nebuchadnezzar. Says, O Assyrian, the rod of mine anger and the staff in their hand is mine indignation. But, O Assyrian, the rod of mine anger. He said, in essence, I'm going to use the Assyrian to whoop my children. And he did. Now look at another passage like that. There's quite a few. Look in Jeremiah chapter 27. Jeremiah 27. And notice verse 6. Nebuchadnezzar in various ways is said at various times to be somebody that the Lord used. Sometimes in a positive way even. You saw him repent when the children of the three Hebrew children didn't bow. He pitched them in. They saw the Son of God down there. They came out without so much as smelling like smoke. And he got right at the time. So sometimes it's a positive thing, but notice verse 6, and now have I given all these lands under the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant. Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant, and a beast of the field. Now what you have to think about with that is, When the Lord brings down on the world some things, for instance, we in history, of course, think about Hitler, and you know, it's just the worst thing you can imagine. God had a use for Hitler. God used Hitler to fulfill what came about of a people that killed his son and said his blood be on us and on all our children. Now, there have been lots of other folks that have whooped up on the Jews and killed the Jews and murdered the Jews and driven the Jews out through history. I mean, in Poland and all over the world. But, you know, we always think of Hitler. Well, it's not like Hitler rose up of his own strength and power. You say, well, it had to be the devil, didn't it? Well, the Lord gives the devil rein to do what he wants to sometimes. The devil gets permission to do what he does, right? Look at here a couple of other things along that line. Look in 1 Chronicles 5. 1 Chronicles 5. Fact of the matter is that the Lord uses the wicked. 1 Chronicles chapter 5. So before you start cursing Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, you better wonder about why we wound up getting them. You know, and if you got a reprieve now, if you did, then praise the Lord. But you better beware lest you get something else worse. Look in 1 Chronicles chapter 5 and verse 25. They transgressed against the God of their fathers and went a-whoring after the gods of the people of the land whom God destroyed before them. And the God of Israel stirred up the spirit of Pul, king of Assyria, and the spirit of Tilgath-Pilneser, king of Assyria, and he carried them away, even the Reubenites and the Gadites and the half-tribe of Manasseh, and brought them unto Halah and Habor and Hara and the river Gozan unto this day. Again, talking about the 10 northern tribes being carried off by the Assyrians. But he said, I raised up the spirit of those two guys. Those two guys are my hand. Those two guys are working my work. And so, you know, folks don't recognize sometimes that in the history of the Muslims, God has always used Muslims since they rose up in the 500s and 600s to absolutely demolish Christianity that's gone to idols. I mean, if there was somebody that had success whooping up on the Catholic Church for a little while and taking away their booty, it was the Muslims. And ladies and gentlemen, I mean, when you look at what America is, I mean, there's a reason 9/11 2001 happened. And it's not because somehow the devil overruled God, because we were so godly and doing so right here in our country. It's not like that at all. Look what he hit. He hit the symbols of power. The World Trade Center was representative of money. And the Pentagon was representative of military might. I mean, somebody ought to take that lesson and go think about that one a little while. And how in the world could, you know, four or five dudes get through and fly our airplanes into those places? Well, you know, the Lord used them. The Lord has always used Islam to beat up on idolatrous Christianity. And so the fact that we still have that problem is indicative of things having not changed too much, no matter what folks say, right? I just remember when 9/11 happened, one of my lasting memories is that, I mean, it had just happened two or three days before, and so there was all this patriotic, you know, this patriotic surge that came on from folks. You were hearing all kinds of stuff on the radio and TV and stuff. I just remember driving down Coon Rapids Boulevard one day. It was down by our church's bank down there. I stopped at the stoplight, and there was this truck, this big, huge, jacked-up four-wheeler truck, mud truck, comes driving by, and he's got a flag the size of a Perkins restaurant flag flying out in the back of his truck. He had rigged it up somehow, so this thing is, you know, furled out behind him. And on his mud flaps were the girly mud flaps you see on trucks, okay? I was thinking, yeah, that's what patriotism's become. You know, girlies and a flag and apple pie and baseball and Chevrolet and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And unfortunately, there was a time when Christianity kind of played into that. And one offshoot of it was that if you were a true Christian, was a true American dyed-in-the-wool patriot in the sense of being for America and everything. And you can't look at what our country's done in some ways. I'm not talking about the common social agenda of you know 21st century media, but as far as being proud or happy or glad about some of the things that our country's done, it's not godly at all, right? So you got to be careful about mixing your patriotism with your Christianity. I'm a Christian, I'm a patriot, and I'm glad to be an American, and I like living here. But just because I'm an American and just because I'm a patriot, that doesn't mean that America is Christian. Because it's not. Okay, back to Psalm 18. And let me just show you one more. Look in 2 Chronicles 36 now that we're nearby. 2 Chronicles 36, I'm just showing you, as it says there, that the wicked sometimes are the tools that God uses. 2 Chronicles and chapter 36. 2 Chronicles 36, and go down to verse 22. And this, of course, is a good context, although he inherited the children of Israel already in captivity. This is Cyrus, king of Persia. Now, in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of the Lord spoken by the mouth of Jeremiah might be accomplished, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, the king of Persia, that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom and put it also in writing, saying, Thus saith Cyrus, king of Persia, all the kingdoms of the earth hath the Lord God of heaven given me. That's an interesting testimony. He hath charged me to build him an house in Jerusalem. Now, again, sometimes somebody like Cyrus comes up and the Lord uses him for a profound positive development. The other case, sometimes it's Paul, the king of Assyria, or Tilgath-Pilneser, king of Assyria, and Nebuchadnezzar, and the Lord uses them to whoop up on the nation because they've done wrong and they're being judged. So sometimes that's what happens. So the next time another Barack Obama or Bill Clinton shows up on the scene, you might contemplate that maybe we got them because we deserve them. I say we collectively, okay? I know that probably for the average Christian here, it's not you that the Lord's after and judging the country about this. I mean, the Lord's not judging the country because of folks like us street preaching and trying to get people saved and trying to live right. But the rest of the country is not living like that. You can testify to that, right? Back to Psalm 17 and verse 14. Still talking about the wicked, which is thy sword, in verse 13. From men, verse 14, which are thy hand. So they're his hand at times. O Lord, from men of the world, which have their portion in this life, and whose belly thou fillest with thy hid treasure, they are full of children and leave the rest of their substance to their babes. And that's talking about sometimes, just like Job complained, it sure looks like the wicked have it all going their way. And sometimes the Lord uses those folks to rub it into rub our noses into it, because even though they're doing wrong and living it, the fact is we shouldn't be envying what they have, right? He says sometimes the wicked get along pretty well for a while. He says they have their portion in this life. Their belly thou fillest with thy hid treasure. They're full of children, and they leave the rest of their substance to their babes. They leave behind a big inheritance and have a lot of money. They're fat. They're enclosed in fat from earlier in the passage. And things seem to be going very good. You can't be deceived by that. You can't be. Verse 15, as for me, this is the one who's pleading that the Lord would deliver him from such people as these. As for me, you've got to keep square what your heritage is. You've got to keep square how you've been blessed, and the fact that however much money you do or do not have in the bank really doesn't have much to do with it. Verse 15, as for me, I will behold thy face in righteousness. You have that hope. David had that hope. One day, you get to get up out of a grave, if nothing else, and behold the Lord's face in righteousness. says there in verse 15, I shall be satisfied when I awake with thy likeness. Now, you know that for me and you, that means we're going to wake up, actually, we're going to leave here and be in the image of God and Christ, soul and spirit. And one day we come back and get our bodies, and then we are really in the image of God then. We get everything then. Now, these folks have a little bit of a different thing. But look in Job chapter 19. All these fellows had the hope of standing and rising in a resurrection and abiding on this earth with the Lord as their king. Look in Job, book of Job, and chapter 19. Job 19. Sometimes you wonder what folks in the Old Testament fully believed. It's not always clear how much they knew at times, because you don't really have epistles written like in the New Testament. So exactly what Abraham believed about some things were left in the dark a little bit, and sometimes even with Job. But Job chapter 19, go down to verse 25. For I know that my Redeemer liveth. He knew he needed a Redeemer. He knew that his Redeemer lived, and that he shall stand at the latter day upon the earth. He's saying there that we know that one day a king's going to come, that God's going to come and stand in the latter day upon the earth. It says, and though after my skin worms destroy this body, yet in my flesh shall I see God. I'm going to rise up one day after I'm dead and stand in my flesh and view God's face. These guys had a positive idea of a resurrection and living before God. Back to chapter 17 of Psalms and verse 15. As for me, I will behold thy face in righteousness. I shall be satisfied when I awake with thy likeness. Chapter 18, verse 1. Again, David, the sweet psalmist of Israel, the man after God's own heart. I will love thee, O Lord, my strength. I will love thee. So, I will love thee. It is an act of will. You don't just fall in love. It is a definitive decision that you decide that you love God. If you're waiting for the feeling to come, you might just as well shut it down. Just decide you're going to love Him, because you should. And the more you get to know Him, maybe you will not have to dutifully love Him at all anymore. Maybe you fall completely in love with Him. But he says, I will love thee, O Lord. He says, I will do it. It is in part a conscious choice, an act of will. Haven't you found that it's that way somewhat even in human relationships? I mean, I get a little tired of hearing folks talking about falling in love, because after all, if you can fall in, you can probably fall out, right? And so I had a cousin who married this guy. She just had to marry this guy, and she did. And then, because she said, fallen in love with him. I'll never forget the day that the family found out that she said, well, I fell out of love with him, so I'm going to divorce him. Well, see, that's the thing, is if you're so busy falling in, then you can just as easily fall out. There has to be a conscious decision to it, right? It's not always, I mean, I'm not suggesting for a moment there shouldn't be a chemistry, and there shouldn't be hormones, and there shouldn't be a mutual attraction. I'm just saying if you're just waiting for the feeling, that might not be all there is to it. Right? I mean, by the time you've been married a little while, as most of you know, it becomes a little more practical than just, you know, every morning. Right? And so he says here, he said, I will love thee, O Lord, my God, my strength. I will love thee. I don't care what happens, I will. I just will. And you should. And you should make that promise, because you can. Sometimes it's a conscious choice. I will love thee, O Lord, my strength. Now, he's mentioned as his strength twice here in verse 1 and verse 2. But he goes on and says in verse 2, the Lord is other things. He is my rock, my fortress, my deliverer, my God, my strength in whom I will trust, my buckler, and the horn of my salvation, and my high tower. There's several things there, right? And in all those things, you get the sense that David is in a precarious situation where he needs something firm to stand on. He needs a rock, a fortress, a safe place of refuge, a safe place to run to and fortify behind some place with bulwarks. My deliverer, sometimes he needs rescue. My God, my strength, in whom I will trust, my buckler. I always thought of buckle when I saw buckler, but I realized later I didn't understand it right. A buckler is like a small shield. It's something like, you know, it's this big around. And you would carry it in the old days, you know, on your arm, and you would parry a blow from a sword with it, but it also had a round bowl-type knob. Sometimes it had a spike on it, so that it not only was a purely defensive weapon where you blocked something like that and, you know, fended off a shield or a sword stroke, but it was also something that you could butt somebody with and jam them and hurt them. So it's a buckler. It's something that you carry in conjunction with your sword. He said, in whom I will trust, my buckler, the horn of my salvation and my high tower. Okay, the horn. The horn of my salvation. I have a hard time defining exactly what a horn is. Look in 1 Samuel chapter 2. If you've ever looked at it, how many of you ever looked at horn in the Bible? I'm not talking about necessarily just the prophetic horns of Daniel's beasts or anything like that, but it's kind of hard to define exactly what the horn is. I think I've kind of got it. 1 Samuel chapter 2. Look down in verse 1. 1 Samuel chapter 2 and verse 1. And Hannah, Samuel's mom, prayed and said, my heart rejoiceth in the Lord, mine horn is exalted in the Lord, my mouth is enlarged over mine enemies, because I rejoice in thy salvation. My heart rejoices, my horn's exalted, my mouth is enlarged, because I rejoice in thy salvation. I think a horn has, I mean, have you ever heard the phrase, he's tooting his own horn? It's almost like that's what you talk about, that's what you brag about, that's what you rejoice in, it's what comes out of your mouth. I think it's in part that. Look also in 1 Chronicles 25. 1 Chronicles 25. I kind of undertook today to figure out, to see if I could find out and settle in my mind what the horn was. 1 Chronicles 25, it's connected with what you rejoice in, what you talk about, what you exult in, what you exalt and talk about. So if you're busy talking about nothing but the Vikings' chances this year, then maybe you're blowing the wrong horn, is the idea. 1 Chronicles chapter 25, go down to verse 5. Now this is a kind of a nondescript passage talking about some of David's men, and it says in verse 5, all these were the sons of Heman, the king's seer, in the words of God, to lift up the horn. Now that horn would be something that you put oil in. So he's a seer, he's a prophet, so he anoints things with that oil. So there's oil in that horn. Well, you know, a horn then would not only be what you speak about and exalt in, things that come out of your mouth, but it would have to do with the carrying of the Holy Spirit. It's like that. And there's still another little issue here. Look in Job 16. Job 16. Job chapter 16, go down to verse 15. 16:15. Job is, of course, complaining, and rightfully so. But he says, verse 14, he breaketh me with breach upon breach. He runneth upon me like a giant. I mean, he's just beaten to death. He feels like the Lord is rolling over him like one of those big road rollers. I have sewed sackcloth upon my skin and defiled my horn in the dust. Now let that one sit there for just a second, because look in Psalms 92. Let me look at one more here, and then I'll tell you what I think it is. Psalm 92 and verse 10. Let's start with verse 9. Let's start with verse 8. But thou, Lord, art most high forevermore. For lo, thine enemies, O Lord, for lo, thine enemies shall perish. All the workers of iniquity shall be scattered. But my horn shalt thou exalt like the horn of an unicorn. I shall be anointed with fresh oil. There's the oil again. The unicorn is brought into it, and a unicorn is supposed to have a horn on his nose. I get that. But the more I read it, the more I think that a horn is like somebody's coat of arms. It's representative of power. It's representative of family. It's representative. It's like a coat of arms, I think. I think when he says, you've exalted my horn, it's like the Lord has come and rescued him and exalted his coat of arms up. Something to be, you know, it's like an ensign, something like that. Anybody else have any thoughts on that? Good, because I didn't want you to tell me I was wrong. All right, verse 3. I will call upon the Lord who is worthy to be praised. So shall I be saved from mine enemies. David here is using that word saved. We talk about somebody saved. We talk about somebody getting saved and being born again. A lot of times in the Old Testament, throughout, somebody's just being saved from death, being saved by the Lord that way, the way we're saved from drowning, that sort of thing. And so, again, there's kind of a double-edged sword there. Notice verse 4. And David is a spiritually, emotionally deep man. And he says, the sorrows of death compassed me, and the floods of ungodly men made me afraid. The sorrows of death compassed me. It's not a mystery why folks start thinking about suicide. Because sometimes life goes this way. It went that way for David. I mean, the man after God's own heart. It went that way for David where the sorrows of death surrounded him. I mean, the hopelessness of things, the trouble in things, a life just in the balance, things not going well. Sometimes you don't really feel like going on. But he said, the sorrows of death compassed me. So he goes on to say, and the floods of ungodly men made me afraid. There's plenty to be depressed about. The floods of ungodly men. I mean, folks, it just gets worse and worse year by year. I mean, don't you remember the old days? Maybe your old days were only a few years ago, because some of you are so young, but people talking about everything going to hell in a handbasket. Well, people were saying that when I was 10 years old and 12 years old. Well, I'm now, well beyond that, and things have just kept getting worse and worse. I mean, I keep saying it, but we keep going from, it took all this time to get the sodomite agenda through for them, and they finally got it legalized, and then within the year, they're talking about transgender. Now it's, somebody is it a cis, C-I-S, where, that's somebody in transition from being a man to a woman or whatever. So it's a new category of people, somebody that's changing genders. They're cis somehow. Sissies? I'm not quite sure. But so what's the point? Well, things just keep getting worse and worse. Well, it says there that the floods of ungodly men made me afraid. And sometimes you can't help but look around. You spend all your time in the news, and it will make you afraid. You get preoccupied by that instead of what you should be taking care of. Instead of what you should be thinking about. It goes on to say, verse 5 even more, the sorrows of hell compassed me about. I mean, torment, hopelessness, regret. Now, it seems like time never ends, the trial never ends. It just goes on and on. Memories, no resolution to anything. Just keeps going on and on and on and on, and you're miserable. Sorrows of death, sorrows of hell, the floods of the ungodly men made me afraid. The snares of death prevented me. The snares of death. Things that'll get you killed. Lust. Sin. The allurements. The seductions of things. The world always exposing herself and trying to draw you into her. That constant thing. The snares of death prevented me. In my distress, I called upon the Lord and cried unto my God. I wonder how many who are discouraged, overwrought, despondent, and distressed with sorrows of death, sorrows of hell, and how bad things are. I wonder how often anymore folks even go to the Lord and cry to Him. It's just so easy to go get a pill. It's just so easy to go find some other outlet by which my social media friends will come and gather around me and offer me their thumbs ups. I feel so much better now. He likes me. Right? I wonder how many even go to the Lord anymore. It says there, "In my distress I called upon the Lord and cried unto my God. He heard my voice." You have a remarkable situation. You have a God unlike any other God in the entire world. He not only died for your sins and rose from the dead, but He hears you. He's the only one that's alive. He's the only one that you can cry to, and He hears you. If He doesn't obviously answer you, you still have the knowledge that He heard you. I mean, if you were stranded, if your plane went down in the middle of Alaska or the Serengeti or some such thing like that in the middle of nowhere, and you were without food and without water, and yet you knew for a fact that your distress signal went out and got through, wouldn't that be a relief to you? I mean, talk about despair. Despair would be going down in the Serengeti or somewhere in the Gobi Desert or some such thing like that, and knowing that nobody heard you. And so now you're just left here to die by whatever death you're going to die. Well, at least with God, even if you don't get an immediate answer in the sense of, "I hear you," you know by promise that He heard you. You know you're not alone. So you don't have to despair. Back to verse 6, "In my distress I called upon the Lord and cried unto my God. He heard my voice out of His temple, and my cry came before Him, even unto His ears. Then the earth shook and trembled, the foundations also of the hills moved and were shaken, because He was wroth." Now we're going to pause there, and I'm not going to start that sequence of verses to talk about the second coming of Christ, but it is good to have a God that's alive. And you know, for all the times that you pray and it seems like nothing happens and there's the heavens are brass and you don't know if you got through, you have to accept by promise that you did get through. We have a mediator, well, an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ, the righteous when we sin, and we have one mediator between God and man. And the Lord died to establish that line of communication between you and God. So does He hear? He hears every time. He hears every single time. All right, let's sing one or two here before we go.